Representative Ortiz, go ahead and tell us a little bit about yourself for the people that might not know much about you.
Well, thank you. Be glad to. And thank you for the opportunity to come in and chat with you today. It's always good to come to Wrangell and to get out and about and to see the folks. And yeah, I've been lucky, very fortunate enough to be the representative for 4 years for District 36. And prior to that, most of you probably know I was a school teacher for 32 years. And most of that time was at Ketchikan High School, where I taught debate and economics and U.S. history. And I was also fortunate enough to be a coach over those years, coached basketball in my earlier career, and then finished up the last 15 years or so being the cross-country coach. So certainly it was a good career that I was fortunate enough to have prior to getting into politics. I would never change anything in the way that I was able to be a teacher and a coach. It was just a wonderful opportunity to shape and impact people's lives. But now, you know, after 32 years, I decided to give politics a run, and so far it's worked out okay. Been elected to 2 terms, and think that overall my record's pretty strong, and feel like it's a record that I don't hesitate in putting up there and asking for consideration in this upcoming election as well.
Absolutely. And you graduated from Ketchikan High School.
I did. I was a graduate from Ketchikan High School way back. That was a long time ago. Let's just put it that way. No, it's 1976. And so graduated from K-High. Went to school at Seattle Pacific University, where I got my BA, and then have gotten a master's at University of Wisconsin in Eau Claire. And I've been in Ketchikan since I was 10 years old and moved there in 1969. And so it's definitely my home. Was fortunate enough to raise 3 children. They're all young adults now. All of them are done with their college education, and they're all out and about. But definitely Ketchikan is my home, and again, just feel very fortunate to be a product of Southern Southeast Alaska.
All right. So you represent Wrangell on the Alaska legislature, for all of these big issues that impact all of Southeast and all of Alaska. But one of the things that happened this year that was really of importance to Wrangell specifically that you had some involvement with was the cleanup of the Byford Junkyard. And I was wondering if you could just tell me a little bit about your influence in that situation, being on the House Finance Committee and in the legislature.
You bet. You know, that I had come to Wrangell and heard about this issue, probably at least a good year before the legislature took the action that it ended up taking. And, I visited the site, went out to the proposed site where they were going to move the materials
It's near Pat's Creek.
Pat's Creek Lake, yes. Saw that site and was able to look at a couple other potential sites as well here on the island. But, you know, was really got clearly a conviction that overall, in the long term, it would be best if we could just get the material off the island. That would be the best thing. However, it was going to cost some significant money and to do that. And so I frankly wasn't that hopeful that it would transpire based on the limitations of the Alaska state budget and particularly the capital budget, and so I just didn't think that it would happen. But in the end, you know, what made the difference was Governor Walker came to Wrangell along with Lieutenant Governor Malott, and they heard about the issue as well, and they became convinced that it would be in the best long-term interests of the community if we could get the material off the island. And so Governor Walker got the ball rolling by requesting that the $5 million be put into the capital budget. And once that request came forward, Then it was my job to say, yeah, let's meet the governor's request here. And I, you know, suggested that we add the $5 million into the budget, and was able to get that through the finance committee, and feel fortunate about that. And then, you know, it made it to the floor and without opposition. So yeah, it was just kind of came together all at once at the end, and I was very, very happy to see that, because, in the long term, I think the residents of Wrangell will be happy to know that that material is gone, it's off the island, and it's completed right now. The project has been completed, correct? I think it has. I think all the material has been removed. I may be wrong on that, but in any case, yeah, I was happy to be a part of that, and feel like it was in the best interest of the community overall.
And other than that, let's talk about the budget. This is a huge topic. How do we balance the budget, and what are the things that you would like to see receive more money, and what are some things you might want to see cut?
It's a very good question, and it's certainly one that I have wrestled with, and we, the legislature, have wrestled with since during the entire 4 years that I've been fortunate enough to be in office. And it all stems from the issue of significant declining oil production and then oil prices. Lots of people remember that oil prices have dropped, and of course now they're on the rebound again. But what they don't often remember is that 15 years ago, Alaska was producing 2 million barrels of oil a day, and now we're producing just over 500,000 barrels of oil a day. And so that is the biggest issue that the state has had to grapple with. Yes, declining prices, bouncing around of prices up and down, that's been an issue, and it's made it difficult to do any long-term planning for what our revenue projections would be. Because of the volatility of oil prices, but the real issue is declining oil production. So with that, since the governor had been in office, he and I were elected at the same time. We've been struggling. You know, the entire legislature and the administration has been struggling with that particular issue. So this past legislative session, the bipartisan House majority that I was a part of put forward a fully balanced budget in the first year of this past session. And as a part of that, it included what we now call as Senate Bill 26. And it also included some significant budget cuts, and to the point where all the different agencies, with the exception of Health and Human Services, as well as education, which are the two big drivers of our budget, every other department has been cut on average at least by 20% on average. And, you know, that's caused some problems. You know, those were cuts that needed to be made, but, you know, we saw the impact of those cuts here in Southeast Alaska with declined Alaska Marine Highway System ferry service, which has had an impact on the community of Wrangell, local bed and breakfasts and things like that, that have been, you know, have lost bookings because of the declined schedule opportunities offered by the Alaska Marine Highway System. Our DOT has been cut. The rest of the Department of Transportation has been cut as well. And so we've seen delays in paving projects like the Evergreen Road project. Now that's, I'm happy to say, is just wrapping up, and it looks really good. It was really fun to come in and arrive at the airport yesterday and to drive on that newly paved Evergreen Road. The reality is that, Department of Transportation and a lot of the different agencies, Fish and Game, we'll talk a little bit more about that here later on in the interview, I hope, have been cut. So now while we, the House majority, was able to pass over a fully balanced budget, the Senate agreed to the Senate Bill 26 portion of that plan, which restructures how we use permanent fund earnings. and they agreed with the budget reductions. But the overall full package, which included an income tax, was not agreed to. And we are left with, after Senate Bill, the passage of Senate Bill 26, which passed the majority of the Republican-led Senate, as well as the House, and a bipartisan effort on the House side as well, we are now left with about a $700 million deficit, which was a $2.5 billion deficit. So to put it a little bit more in concrete terms, with the restructuring of the permanent fund dividend, not the dividend, but the permanent fund itself, we will now use in this fiscal year some of the earnings from the permanent fund investment returns towards government services in the amount of approximately $1.5 billion and or $1.7 billion, and so that's why the deficit has been dropped to $700 million. So we still have got that to go, and we have declining savings accounts. So it's looking more favorable, though, that this particular year we're probably going to be okay, based on the fact that oil prices have rebounded. They've been close to $80 a barrel. They're still popping around between $75 and $83, $84 a barrel. But it seems like that if they hold at an average of at least $75 a barrel for the year, that that $700 million deficit will be addressed, and we won't need to tap savings further or look at other revenue measures. So that's the hope. Of course, the problem with that is that I just said that's the hope. And the thing with oil prices, just like they go up, they also go down. And so I don't think that we're being completely forthright if we don't point out to the voters of the state of Alaska that in the end, we're going to need a solid, dependable source of added revenue, whether that's in the form of a sales tax or in the form of an income tax or some other type of added revenue. In the end, it seems likely that that's going to be the call for the day. However, in this upcoming year, I don't expect the House majority to offer that income tax proposal. If it comes, it would come from the Senate side, and then we'd have to take a look at that because, you know, it's going to have to be addressed. We all want our schools paid for. We all want our roads to continue to be maintained, and we all want our fishing game, our fishing resources to be managed well, and that takes money. And we've been very, very fortunate over the last 30 years, 40 years, not to have any kind of a statewide tax, with the exception of the property taxes that all the borough areas pay, that goes towards education. It covers some of the cost of education. With the exception of that, we haven't made any real contributions into the state for all the different things that the state does because we've been supported by ample oil tax revenues. So eventually I think the issue is going to have to be addressed, but I don't expect it to be addressed this particular legislative year. So.
Okay. Yeah. So potentially taxes, dip it into PFDs.
Yeah, you know, the PFD is a rightfully so. It's a sacred thing for all of Alaskans. It's something that it's a concrete example of how we as Alaskans are the resource owners. We are the ones that under the Constitution own the oil that's on Alaska state land. It's not the oil companies that own the oil. They lease the rights to be able to drill for that oil and to be able to, you know, to pump that oil up out of the ground and to get it to market, and they lease that. And that's something that, but in the end, that the owners, that's, everybody has to remember that, the owners are the people of Alaska. So that dividend has been the direct representation that that's our, quote, our share of the profits that we get for pumping our oil out of the grounds of Alaska. With that said, you know, the governor in his second year in office capped the dividend, and we're all aware of that. And, you know, that was a very, very gutsy thing for him to do. But he did it specifically because he was concerned about the long-term future of the permanent fund itself and the long-term future of the state being able to pay out a dividend. So then this last year, as a part of Senate Bill 26, the Senate introduced the bill that said, okay, we're going to use some of these earnings for state services, and we're still going to give a dividend. And this past year, it was $1,600, which was, I think, the eighth highest dividend in the history of the program, and about $500 above the average dividend. Over the years, the average dividend has about been about $1,100, and this year's dividend was $1,600. I'm very much interested in constitutionalizing the dividend so that that's the only way that we can protect the issuance of a dividend to every qualifying Alaskan residents into the future is if we constitutionalize it. And so that's with something that I would be interested in with a bill, and then it would call for a vote of the people. And once that happened, that would be the steps necessary to amend the Constitution to put that in there. And I would be a big supporter of that because that enshrines the dividend well into the future, not just for myself, not just for my children, but for my children's children and their children's children, which is what I think would be the best thing to do. But can we afford to give out a full, what they call the full dividend, the way they first calculated the formula? You know, I've looked at the numbers. I'd like to be able to do it. The fact that we capped it, you know, the past couple of years has cost my family on average about $5,000 a year because I have five members in the family. And I'd like to have that money just like everybody else. But I think what's more important is that we look to the long term and that we pay out the maximum amount that is affordable, the maximum amount that is feasible, and then the maximum amount that won't jeopardize the future of the dividend and won't jeopardize the future of the permanent fund itself. So that's where I stand on the issue. And, you know, and I challenge any candidate running for office who says that they would like to restore, quote, the full dividend, I would like to understand how that will happen. What cuts will be further need to be made to the budget in order to afford to pay out that full dividend? It's pretty clear that at this point, you're only going to find the cuts from education and from health and human services, our pioneer homes, things like that. The rest of the budget has been cut to the bone already. Not that there won't be some efficiencies found in the rest of the budget. There will be. But any significant cuts now are going to have to come from health and human services and from education. And it's either that or you're talking about a different tax to support that full dividend. And so I challenge anybody, and I have not heard, you know, candidate Dunleavy, who's running for governor, who's calling for a full permanent fund. I have not heard yet. I've yet to hear the plan as to how he will accomplish that and still preserve the dividend in the future and still and not have to cut education significantly and health and human services. So I'm all ears. If it can be done, I'd like to hear about it.
And so these are the two things that you say we can't cut these. These are the two vital things that need to be fully funded.
Well, I think, yeah, I mean, in this past budget cycle, we were able to put in, on average, I believe it was $78 more per student enrolled in the state of Alaska towards their education the contribution that the state makes towards their education has been up by $78 this upcoming fiscal year, and then the next fiscal year it's scheduled to be increased another, I believe, $30 on top of that, or $38 on top of that. So, but it's not in the, what they call the formula. It's not been put in the formula. So it's still subject to final approval from upcoming legislatures. But that's what we had agreed to. And yeah, I'm not going to apologize that when we, for that. When we talk about, first of all, education, that is a mandated constitutional obligation. It says quite clearly that the state of Alaska needs to provide for, I think the words are, quote, an adequate education for every Alaskan child between the ages of 5 and 18. And that highlights how we in the state see it as the ultimate investment in our future. Investing in education is investing in the future. It's investing in the people who will become our leaders. It's investing in the people who will become the decision makers. And it's investing in their education, which in the end will help to make them productive citizens in the future, citizens that contribute with their efforts to the economy of the state of Alaska. And so it all starts with education. And granted, I'm probably a little bit biased coming out of a 32-year degree or 32 years of experience in education, but still, I think everybody agrees that we need to continue to, as we make cuts, we need to continue to look at education and make sure that we're doing everything we can to provide for our future generations. And then when you start talking about health and human services, you're talking again about programs that some are not cuttable because they're part of federal mandated formula programs. And we're partners with the federal government on those programs, and we just can't unilaterally cut those programs without going against our obligations to those federally mandated programs. Or if you don't go there and if you start cutting other programs, then you're talking about programs like our Pioneer Homes. And to me, one of our biggest priorities should be our senior citizens and continuing to try to find ways to support our senior citizens here in their ability to stay in Alaska, stay in their original home, stay in the state, which they've made so many contributions to and helped to make the state what it is today. It seems to me that we need to remain committed to them and doing whatever we can to make it possible for them to remain in the state of Alaska. So, I'm not going to apologize for that. I think that we owe that to those people who've done so much to contribute to our state of Alaska. And now they're senior citizens, and we need to make sure that Alaska remains a home for them.
Absolutely. So we'll just go through some specific topics real quick. We have a really big deficit with our Medicaid. What is going to happen?
As a part of that overall health and human services budget, Medicaid is a driver to those costs. However, I think the statistics show that once the state accepted Medicaid expansion, we ended up saving our coffers money, and we would have been obligated for more of the expenses that mount up in emergency rooms for people who don't have insurance. One or two things can happen in that situation. If you're a person without insurance, and if you get injured, it's a good thing that an emergency room won't turn you away. That's a very good thing. People shouldn't be turned away from life-saving care if they need it. And so in the past, when someone without insurance was in that situation, it was either the hospital that had the uncollected bill for the services that they rendered, and you can't have too many of those for those hospitals to remain viable, or the state ended up chipping in and help covering those costs. And in the end, the amount of money that we were kicking into those types of costs was more than what we're doing right now in relationship to being partners in the Medicaid expansion program. There's not a lot of easy answers out there. I think that there's certainly improvements that can be made to how services are delivered, not to how they're delivered so much, but how, to how they're rendered, and then the billing for those from the hospitals. There's some changes that can be made, but in the end, I think Medicaid expansion has been a good thing for the state of Alaska, and it's been a saver of money for the state. And there's questions out there about you know, how to keep that program sustainable, but I think we need to be partners in coming up with the questions rather than just trying to wash our hands from Medicaid, because in the end, that's their access to health insurance, and so I don't think we want to abandon their ability to have access to that health insurance.
Yeah. But will we have enough money for it come June?
I think we're going to be fine this coming fiscal year. Again, oil prices have rebounded a bit, and so this coming year will be fine. But the long term, you know, tough questions are going to need to continue to be answered, and that's why, you know, I'm hopeful to be a part of those solutions and hopeful to have a voice in those solutions. And we'll just see what the voters say about that, though.
Mm-hmm. Definitely. Yeah. And then just maybe two more topics. So you're involved in our fisheries and fishing game. Tell us a little bit about your involvement and what you've been able to do.
Absolutely. You know, as when I took this job, I took it to be a representative for District 36, for all of District 36, to be a voice and an advocate for the people of District 36. And it was real clear. The economic statistics are clear. The number one driver of our economy overall here in southern Southeast Alaska is the fishing industry. So I immediately, once I was elected, I immediately asked to be put on the fisheries committee, and I was able to do that and serve on the fisheries committee. And then this past year, this past legislative cycle, two-year legislative cycle, I was a member of the House Finance Committee, and in that role, I was the sub-finance chair of the Fish and Game Department, and as well as a continuing member on the fisheries committee. And, you know, that budget had been cut previously to the point where Fish and Game was no longer able to do some of the projects that they needed to do in order to get accurate assessments as to the escapement levels of salmon heading up rivers and other different species that they manage as well. They were no longer able to do all the different for lack of a better word, measurements, I'm not sure how they do it, estimated escapement levels, things like that, putting people on rivers to count fish, those kinds of things. So this past year, I was able to increase the budget of Fish and Game so that they could do some specific projects which would allow them to potentially offer more fishing opportunity for a commercial fishing fleet. And I felt really good about that. Even though, you know, the fiscal times are hard, there's certain decisions that need to be made in order to preserve our future. And to me, you know, we have to invest in our fisheries because that is a renewable, returnable resource that will last for as long as we are good managers of that resource, well into the future if we manage those resources well. And so my role in adding to that Fish and Game budget was all about trying to give the Fish and Game Department more tools so that they could do a better job and potentially offer more fishing opportunity to our commercial fishing fleet. Then also, as a part of my role in the legislature, I was able to pass House Bill 56, which was a bill that expanded the opportunity for fishermen to borrow money from what they call the Revolving Loaned Fishermen's Fund, and so that they could use that money to buy a bigger boat or to buy a license or to put in improvements on their boat. It just broadened the categories for which a fisherman could borrow money from the Revolving Loan Fund. And what I feel best about is it made it more possible for younger fishermen to enter into the industry, not just as deckhands, but potentially as captains. Maybe they'll get their first gillnetter, or maybe they'll get their first troller, be able to enter into the industry as captains and be this new upcoming source of labor that we're going to need to have as the state has seen what they call the graying of the fleet. The average fish captain in the state of Alaska and coastal Alaska has been getting older and older. And eventually, you know, if we don't solve that problem, if we don't have the younger fishermen coming in as captains and as vessel owners, then that's going to be a problem for the overall industry. So House Bill 56 helped to address that issue, and then I passed a similar bill to help expand the mariculture industry, which is a big possibility for us here in coastal Alaska. It's a great opportunity for us to expand that already very important fishing industry to mariculture products. When we talk about mariculture, we're talking about raising seaweed. We're talking about raising oysters. Oyster company that's owned down in the Ketchikan area by Trevor Sandy and his operations is just getting on board now, and they're starting to produce a lot of oysters, and they're looking for other ways to expand into seaweed and other types of things as well. And then there's another proposed project out there on Prince of Wales Island that's even a bigger project that will be doing seaweed, oysters, those kinds of things. And here's the deal. The market for our products, for Alaskan products, is never going to go away. The Asian population continues to grow. They're the main buyers of these Alaskan seafoods. So we know we have the demand for the products. We just need to put in place the infrastructure and put in place the businesses so that we can meet the demand there well into the future. And potentially, you could see the fishing industry increase by another $1 billion a year. I'm talking a ways down the road, but still, it's there. And again, the sky is the limit, but we do need to be able to put into place the infrastructure and put into place the regulations to make sure that we move forward that part of the industry in a positive direction. So those are some things that I've done in the fishing industry, and there are a few more things as well, but we realize we only have so much time. So, fishing is really important to me, and it was important from the very beginning of my service, and it will continue to be that.
Absolutely. Okay, last question. Okay. So last question, tell us what you want to see happen with the ferry service. Do we need more money put into it? Do we need better schedules? Do we want this to be a public corporation?
That is a good question. And I am waiting, like everyone else, for what they call Southeast Conference to submit their revised bill. They introduced a bill to restructure the Alaska Marine Highway system. And they were given that task by the governor, and they've answered the call, and they've done a lot of legwork, and they've gone to the different communities, and they've heard communities' concerns. Their committee is made up of a broad-based group of folks who are all interested in the Marine Highway system, they've done a lot of groundwork, and in this next year, they're going to introduce a revised bill. With that bill that they did introduce at the end of the session, I can't remember the number, but it didn't get much airtime because it kind of got caught up at the very end, and we were dealing with the budget and other bigger issues for the state of Alaska. So I'm looking forward to looking at that plan that they're putting forward. But it's, from my understanding, it's based on the idea of creating some autonomy for the Alaska Marine Highway System, making them an independent authority similar to the Alaskan Railroad, Giving them some autonomy from administration to administration so that they can make decisions more based on the long-term interests of the users of the marine highway system rather than the new political ideas that come forward or the new ideas that come forward with each administration, which has been the problem over the last 20 years or so. We've had one governor who says, okay, this is what we're going to do with the marine highway system, and then they go through that cycle for a while and maybe build a ferry or two to match that plan, and then you get a different administration in and they have a different plan, and so then you're left with the decisions that were made in the previous and the boats that you have in the previous administration, and it's just difficult. And I'm excited to hear what Southeast Conference has to say and look at their plan, give it some good scrutiny, and again to make sure that the marine highway system is there for us in the future, because, you know, our geography is not going to change. Southeast Alaska is always going to be in a community of islands, and it's going to be a community that relies on water travel in order to get products and people from place to place, whether it's our schools competing in interscholastic competition or whether it's our fishing industry getting their products down to market. That marine highway system has been the lifeblood of the economy of coastal Alaska, not just Southeast Alaska, but coastal Alaska. And it's important that we do what we can as representatives and as citizens and as people who are interested in the economy of coastal Alaska, that we do what we can to ensure the survival of the Alaska Marine Highway System. Because the folks up in the interior and the folks in the rail belt, they don't always remember the importance of the system overall. They don't always remember the fact that the marine highway system brings visitors and tourists to them. I think Fairbanks gets a good share of the Alaska marine highway travelers as far north as is their community in Fairbanks. But out of sight, out of mind is the problem that we have with the marine highway system. But I try to do my role as a representative to at least keep it in the minds of the legislators about the importance of the marine highway system.